Welcome to the Good Neighbor Podcast, where we share stories of hope and healing with the Baylor and Waco communities. My name is Dr. Josh Ritter, and I'm the Assistant Director for Spirituality and Public Life. And on this podcast, we share our stories to remind each other that we all belong and we are all needed to be good neighbors to each other. Today, we are very fortunate to have Dr. Rishi Sriram with us. Welcome, Rishi.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, very excited. So, could you start just by telling us maybe how you got to Baylor, how long you've been here, what you do here?
Yeah, sure. I came to Baylor in the fall of 1998 as a student, and I have never left. So I did my undergraduate degree here and my master's.
Oh.
And even though I did my PhD in higher education at Azusa Pacific University,
uh-huh.
because it was a PhD in higher education, they encouraged all their students to have full-time jobs mm-hmm. in higher education administration mm-hmm. across the world, really.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to Southern California for 3 weeks in January and July mm-hmm. each mm-hmm. year for mm-hmm. our classes. So
okay.
I've served for the kind of first half of my career in student life in various areas. And this latter half of my career has been as a faculty member in the School of Education.
Now, hold on a minute. 98, undergrad. Okay, so I was here during that time as an undergrad.
Are you upset that we weren't friends?
Yes, I am upset that we weren't friends. Because I was here in 96 to 2000 for my undergrad.
Okay.
But I had no idea that you did your undergrad here.
Yes.
So that is amazing. And we were here at the same time.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. And then you just kind of stayed here.
I've never left.
Okay. All right.
They've tried a couple times. But
to get rid of you.
Yes.
Okay. I see. All right. So that's how you got to Baylor. And did you say, what made you come to Baylor in the first place?
Well, that's a long story that I'll try not to be long-winded about, but I was raised Hindu and became a Christian against my parents' will and desire when I was roughly the age of 13.
Oh, okay.
And
where was this?
This was in Austin.
Austin, okay.
Yes. So being in Austin, I knew that I did not want to go to UT and was looking at options, and my brother, older brother, was here at Baylor, and I wasn't really keen on the idea, but he said, come visit me, and I've visited once and thought this is where I wanted to be.
Okay. All right. So you were raised Hindu, and but your older brother was here.
That's right.
Okay. So then did he also become a Christian?
Yes.
And your parents still did not?
Yes, that's
okay.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And if you don't mind me asking, what made you decide to leave the tradition of Hinduism when you're 13? Is that what you said?
Yes.
And become a Christian?
Well, I would say that there's always been in me a belief in God,
mm-hmm.
But there was never any sense of actually being able to relate to God.
Mm.
And when my brother, who became a Christian before me,
mm-hmm.
Introduced me to the notion of there are people out there who think that God is love. It was something so simple, was pretty mind blowing for me,
mm-hmm.
Because I was part of a religion where there were lots of stories about gods and lots of stories about gods interacting with people, but never in this way of authentic love or relationship. Mm-hmm. And so much of my Hindu experience had been based upon tradition and ritual and not an experience with the living God. Mm-hmm. And so when someone said, hey, God might actually be alive, I thought, I should try that out and see if he's there. And that was an experience that led me to say, okay, God, if you are a living God, I want to know you.
Okay. Okay. Now, I mean, in Hinduism, there's also a strong message of God as love, but that was not part of your particular Hindu experience.
That's correct.
You experienced it more as a sort of impersonal.
Yeah, my experience would be probably more parallel to what I read in mythology.
Okay.
Than anything else.
Is there anything that you brought with you that you still are like, that's a really important piece of my faith tradition, but you sort of carried it over into your Christian belief or practice?
I would say that it has been a journey to appreciate and my cultural heritage.
Mm-hmm, right.
And find at least part of my identification in being Indian, mm-hmm. while also being a Christian. I think in some ways I would say, whether it was because of my age or maturity or both, that there was a lot of needing to let go, put aside my Indianness in the pursuit of wanting to know God through Jesus. Hmm. And after some time, I think I've been able to appreciate that who I am and who my parents are and my heritage in ways that maybe I couldn't before.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a fascinating and also difficult journey, because you're talking about really specific identities, and people's religious identity is so much a part of their larger cultural identity, and how those sort of intertwine in significant ways. It's not always immediately evident for everybody. So then you have been here for a long time now, you know, relatively speaking. Can you tell us your specific title at the moment?
Sure. I serve in a few roles. Mm-hmm. One is I am an associate professor, mm-hmm. in the Department of Educational Leadership, mm-hmm. Particularly teaching in our minor in leadership studies and our master's in higher education, and we have a PhD in higher education. Mm-hmm. I also serve as associate chair in that department, so I bear some leadership and administrative responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And then my third role at Baylor is that I serve as what we call faculty steward of Brooks Residential College. So I am, I help to oversee and serve as a faculty in residence in Brooks College, which is a community of approximately 350 students of all classifications and all majors. Mm-hmm.
So that sounds like a lot. and a family?
Yes, I have a wife and three children.
Oh, my.
A son who's 14.
Okay.
A daughter who is 11 and a daughter who's 9.
Oh, my.
So life is full.
Right. So that sounds very full.
Yeah.
Okay. 9, 11, 14. Mm-hmm. plus like all the other things. Do you all live in Brooks?
Yes. Yeah, so my family of five, mm-hmm. and our dog have lived with college students in community for, we're approaching 5 years now.
Whoa. Well, I mean, that's really all I have to say is whoa. Is there 5 years? And you've all enjoyed this.
Loved it.
Loved it.
Yes.
Wow. Not just enjoyed it. Loved it.
Yes.
What is your thing that you love most about it, would you say, after doing this for 5 years?
I think our society is losing an understanding of our need for community and even maybe how to do community.
Mm-hmm.
We're becoming increasingly isolated mm-hmm. from one another. A Brooke student of mine just recently told me about a book that he's reading for class called Alone Together. And I thought that title says a lot, that we're alone together and that's how we operate. And so, whether it be through my church experience or through my professional life, work life, I have tried to really seek community and receive the transformational benefits of community and to understand that whatever costs come from community are so worth it.
Hmm. Can you tell us an example of one cost? Like, what does that mean?
I think community does require a loosening of what I might call privacy.
Right.
Not that you know, I think a private life and a communal life are competing goals, and not that you can't achieve aspects of both. But community requires a willingness to give up some privacy, I think.
Yeah.
I think it also requires vulnerability.
Right.
So if I teach classes only, I can show students my best self always.
Right.
If I live with my wife and 3 children with college students, then they get to see me when I'm not at my best, when I'm not polished. And that leads to vulnerability. And it leads to them seeing me in my great moments with my children and in my frustrated moments with my children. And they get to see how my wife and Amanda and I interact on a daily basis. And that there is a fishbowl experience to that. There is a vulnerability that comes from that. And I think it's beautiful and I think it's wonderful, but to say that there isn't a cost, I don't think would be fair.
Oh, I agree. That sounds like a significant cost. I mean, I'm just thinking about my own sort of interactions with my family. That would be really difficult. Like you said, the polish is not there.
Yes.
When you present your sort of professor self to your students in class.
Yes.
But then you have to like leave class, but then you still go home to live with students. Yeah, that's tough. Wow.
But I think it has helped me to be more of who I am in the classroom.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And I think it's helped me to maybe let go a little bit of the image that I want to present to everyone all the time.
Yeah, the image, the ethos that we sort of cultivate, but also creates a distance.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. And that's fast. And also you called the vulnerability beautiful, which is, after 5 years of doing it, for you to be able to say that and not say like, oh, it's so exhausting. I feel like that's what I would say, right? This vulnerability, I'm just exhausted. Okay, so a beautiful vulnerability. But so many times I think beautiful things in life are difficult things that do require
I agree.
A cost.
Yeah, I think that's well said.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the HESA program, because I don't know, not everybody that's listening is going to be familiar. Can you just tell us briefly about the HESA program here at Baylor?
I'd love to do so. HESA stands for Higher Education and Student Affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And student affairs is a part of the college experience that emphasizes what happens primarily outside of the classroom. So we are, it's a graduate program, master's program for people who want to work as college administrators. And most of them are thinking about roles that they can play outside the classroom that might lead to student success and flourishing. So those might include a residence hall director. It might include academic advising. It might even include jobs at the front end, like admissions, finding the right fit for college students, and even choosing and selecting their institution of higher education. And recently, about 4 years ago, we were able to build on the foundation of that program and start a PhD in higher education studies and leadership, which is essentially studying colleges and college students. So it's a lot of fun.
Right.
And it's really important work because overall, in the United States and beyond, we're not doing as well as we could in helping college students achieve their goals and maybe in helping us achieve the goals that we have for college students.
And overall, probably the word is thrive. But that has a specific meaning within the higher ed context, correct?
Yeah, and I think there are several meanings even within the higher education context. My dissertation advisor, Lori Schreiner, talks about thriving from more of a psychological perspective. And then I have a colleague in my department, Perry Glanzer, who might talk about thriving more in terms of human flourishing. I think they're talking about the same thing, but maybe from different disciplines.
Okay. Now, I have worked with several students in the HESA program. They've always been excellent, and one of them for sure has been on this podcast, and the other one will soon be on this podcast. But what do you think? What do you think is the number one thing that students take away from the Baylor HESA program?
Well, you asked for one.
Oh.
May I give two?
Two, great.
Okay, thank you. The first would be that we pride ourselves as being pretty academically rigorous.
Okay.
We believe in the study of colleges and college students.
Okay.
And we think that this isn't the type of thing that you walk in and say, I'm good with people, and therefore there are systematic changes that need to take place. There's a lot of theory regarding the development of college students. There's history to understand about colleges in the first place, organizational theory about how to lead in a college setting, laws pertaining to higher education specifically. So we're academically rigorous. We want people who are willing to do the hard thinking.
Okay, so we're first talking about theoretical rigor in terms of the field overall, and then you're also talking about qualitative and quantitative research analysis.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes. And I say that as unique to Baylor, not because there aren't other programs that require such academic rigor. I just think that Baylor's is one of the most rigorous that I've come across.
Okay.
And the second is the way we believe that the Christian faith can amplify the learning experience, which we think is particularly important because it's faith that started higher education in America. And it's sort of been since pushed to the side. And yet we know that these 18 to 25-year-old students, at least some of them are in that age span, are going through significant changes in their lives,
of course, and
how they think about life, and that faith is or can be a really important aspect of that. And I worry that maybe higher ed as a discipline has gone too far in ignoring those aspects. And so I think that there's something really important to study faith-wise in terms of the big picture institutions. Why was Wake Forest founded as a Baptist institution? Why is Wake Forest no longer, in essence, a Baptist institution? Why is Baylor so committed to integrating and keeping its Christian faith as part of its mission? Why is that important? And then I think on the individual level, if we're going to care about the success of college students, a part of that needs to be an understanding of the moral and faith development of college students. And I think Baylor has a unique perspective on that. And if nothing else, we welcome conversations around that in ways that maybe other institutions don't.
Specifically regarding higher ed programs.
Yes.
Okay. So a couple things pop into my head. One, I completely agree with you that religious identity, faith identity is a really understudied, underdeveloped piece of a student's cultural identity when they come to university contexts, especially as they're going through this really sort of, you know, I don't use the word unique very often because because of its definition. But I mean, I think that this moment in a student's life is a unique moment in their specific life, where they are undergoing an enormous amount of identity formation. And I think that thinking through the way they understand and relate to their particular faith and religious identity, is a big piece of that, that is unrecognized, right, in a lot of programs, or ignored, or just sort of barely acknowledged.
Yes. Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And I think it gives credence to the kind of work that you're doing, Josh, because I think we have to think about how we can help students reflect upon their faith journeys.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, another thing that comes to mind is, so whenever the Baylor HESA program is talking specifically about moral development in students, and you're talking about institutes of what's the word I'm looking for? Well, faith-based. I don't know why I couldn't think of based. Faith-based institutions. So Wake Forest, other, you know, Notre Dame, other institutions, Georgetown, in DC. Institutions that were founded upon a particular faith tradition. Some have maintained that. Some have gone away from that. Most recently, I think we see that with TCU, that's yes. a close neighbor of ours. Baylor's attempting to hold on to their particular identity. I think it's really important when we talk about traditions and identities, right? Because we have a particular tradition that we're affirming, but we have that's a but we also have specific, more specific identities that we're also affirming. Baylor has the tradition of Baptist, though I've noticed that a lot of people that work for Baylor and go to Baylor don't know a whole lot about Baptist identity.
Yes.
Or historical Baptist heroes, or what Baptists have historically stood for or against. So I do think that is also important. Now, if a student, though, and I ask because I am genuinely curious and I have no idea, if a student who's not a Christian wanted to come to the HESA program here at Baylor, I mean, that would be I mean, I assume that would be fine because that's fine for any student.
Yeah, actually, it would not be.
Okay.
Yeah, we. I think that that's a great thing for Baylor's undergraduate programs, that we welcome people of all faiths. But in our higher education graduate programs, we actually do want our students to have a Christian faith.
Okay. Okay.
Because we think that there are already lots of places available,
right.
programs available
sure.
for students to learn a lot about higher education who mm-hmm. don't have a Christian faith.
Right.
There are not many programs that are trying to really address the questions of what does the Christian faith have to say about our work in
sure.
higher education.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore we try to have a really big tent,
mm-hmm.
We want students who would call themselves Christians.
Okay. So that's a question on the application then.
It's one that we, ask, in the interview process. Yes.
Okay. Okay. That's part of your overall academic trajectory. Right, is to study the faith formation from a Christian perspective.
Yes, and it's not that we expect our students to go work specifically in Christian higher education.
Right, right.
We just want, from a learning standpoint, our students to come with the desire to learn about what the Christian faith might have to say about our work in higher education.
Okay. I did not know that.
Yeah, and so, you know, would it be possible for somebody who is not a Christian but sincerely desires that experience to be accepted into our program? I think so.
Okay.
I just think that that's a rare thing for someone who is not a Christian to desire a distinctly Christian perspective on the work of higher education.
Yeah, I was going to say, because, I mean, it kind of popped into my head. Folks who, for example, you know, they get a degree in religious studies, right? Because religious studies is not really, it's just about the study of religion, that and that is fascinating to people. And usually they're from all different faith traditions. And so I wondered, somebody who was just genuinely curious, you know, maybe they were a Muslim, but they were really fascinated to know the perspective of a Christian higher ed program. So you're, and you think that would be like not a problem, but rare.
Yeah. I think it would be something that we would be open to as faculty. I would say it's extremely rare. I think the experiences that we have, for those who just haven't spent much time exploring or thinking about their
mm-hmm,
faith.
Right.
When it comes to our Christian mission, that their response is more often, I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, I'm okay that you all do that. And
mm-hmm.
that's not the type of student we're looking for at the graduate level. We don't want students who are okay with our Christian mission.
Mm-hmm.
We want students who choose Baylor in part because of our Christian mission.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Well, I do want to switch gears here at this point because I want to hear about your current research. You are currently working on a book, and I would love to hear all about this book.
So, Josh, I am. I have a crazy idea.
Okay.
And my idea is that there is no such thing whatsoever. There is no such thing as innate talent.
Okay.
That
at all.
That's correct.
Okay.
All of talent is what I would say is cultivated, developed,
mm-hmm.
and earned.
Okay.
And when I say talent, I mean that includes intelligence as well.
Okay.
And this has been a long journey for me.
And just to be clear, before we move on, because I do want to hear why it's a long journey, but you're talking about intelligence and also athletic-like ability and like motor skill ability, like any of these things that we do think typically that we have innate sort of born with talents. That's what you're talking about, right?
That's correct. Isn't that crazy?
It is a little bit crazy.
It's a little bit crazy. yes. So I would, if we were looking for a definition of talent, I would say that it's any skill that's executed successfully.
Okay.
And so that would include physics, athletic performance, mm-hmm. music, leadership. Yeah, you name it.
Okay. Now, before we start grilling you on this, you know, what why has this been a long journey?
Well, when I started my PhD program, I ran across the work of Carol Dweck, who is a psychologist at Stanford who's gained some popularity.
Sure.
Her book Mindset had just come out.
Is this the Dweck who does some stuff on like grit and...
So Angela Duckworth is a student of Dweck's.
Okay, that's where I'm at.
And, yeah. And she is the one who does grit, but okay. They are connected okay. Relationally and professionally
okay.
Also.
Okay, great.
So Carol Dweck basically discovered that the theories that we have about our capacity to change have pretty phenomenal impact on our behaviors. And she simplifies this into two theories. Mm-hmm. She calls one the fixed mindset. Mm-hmm. And it's the belief that your talent is fixed, that what you have is what you have, that it's innate, mm-hmm. And that you can't change in any significant or meaningful way. And the alternative theory would be the growth mindset, which is the belief that you can fundamentally change in your talent. And it's domain specific. So mm-hmm. you could have a fixed mindset about music, but a growth mindset about basketball. Mm. You know, we probably as a society have a fixed mindset about math more than anything else. Maybe athletic ability would be a close second. So it's not that we necessarily have just one mindset. And it's also not a conscious thing mm-hmm. that this is something that she would describe as an implicit belief mm-hmm. Underlying behind the scenes, but that can have a phenomenal impact on how we behave and specifically how we might respond to failures and how we might respond to successes. And mm-hmm. I did my dissertation on this idea, particularly with high-risk college students, and really fell in love with it, but it left me with a pretty a big question. One of the domains of mindset that she's most interested in is intelligence. Do you have a fixed mindset of intelligence mm-hmm. or a growth mindset of intelligence? Well, Dr. Dweck is dealing with beliefs, and beliefs are really important, but mm-hmm. I also wanted to know reality. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's nice to know that if I believe that my intelligence can be grown, some positive benefits will come from that. Can my intelligence be grown? That's a totally different question that I thought was really important. So I just started to study intelligence. I've spent the last 10 years studying things that I have no business studying, and intelligence is one of those things. And I came to learn crazy things, like the inventor of the IQ test, Alfred Binet, firmly believed that intelligence could be developed. And that's mm-hmm. actually why he created the IQ test, so mm-hmm. that he could demonstrably show that his methods increased the intelligence of the children that he was working with in French public schools. Huh. And this got me on a journey of neuroscience mm-hmm. where I really started mm-hmm. to learn about the brain and how it works, and started to realize that, that while, most experts would say intelligence is somewhere in the vicinity of 50% innate or genetic mm-hmm. and 50% environmental, mm-hmm. Nature versus nurture. Mm-hmm. You know, there are two things about that. One is that's a huge leap from where we were 20 years ago, where we might have said 95% is innate mm. and 5% is environmental or nurture.
Oh.
And it just seems like as time goes on,
mm-hmm.
and technology gets better in terms of our understanding of the brain,
mm-hmm.
We are on a path where we're seeing more and more of the impact of the environment. Well, when I studied this, I wasn't trying to create some radical conclusion that would add shock value. I was just wanting to know the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And as I've studied intelligence, the brain, talent, the conclusion that I've come to is that it's all developed.
Okay. Okay. So a couple things then, 'cause that was a lot of information. You mentioned before that we have these different areas where we might ascribe an innate, and then in other areas we might say sort of more developed. And I'm thinking of, you said math. Sometimes I think we do, they're just good with numbers. Athletics, I would say, would be a huge one, right? Especially people who are fast, right? Oh, they're just born fast. Right.
Right.
And then I would also say music, I think. I don't know if you've come across that, but I think some people would say they're just more musically inclined.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that we do this.
Yes.
I mean, I think we mostly think in fixed terms. I would say that's the popular conception.
And I think America, the United States in particular, is obsessed with innate talent.
Yes.
I mean, we just got through the Olympics, right?
And yes,
we love the notion of this magical person who could do magical things.
Magical person. Yes. And there's also America's Got Talent. And
yes.
There's also American Idol.
Yes.
And there's also, what's the dance one?
Isn't it funny that we use the word idol?
Yes, it is. Is it who can, wait, what?
So You Think You Can Dance.
So You Think
is
You Can
what
Dance.
I would guess if I watched such shows, which I'm not admitting to.
Very
whatsoever.
Good. Yeah. Very good. I like that, how you did that there. Yeah, I think you are right about, okay, so that is a fascinating thing in and of itself, that we turn people who we believe do have innate talent into idols. People that we worship, aspire to be like, want to know more about, etc. Yes?
Yes.
So why do you think we do that?
Well, I think that some of it comes from our lack of education regarding talent. And that's really why I want to write this book, Josh, is because If we're told that talent is innate and we see people who are much more talented than we are,
mm-hmm.
then there is something magical about them. They are special, and it does two things. It elevates them on a pedestal that, quite frankly, I don't think they deserve.
Mm-hmm.
And it excuses us from developing ourselves. And I think we lose some responsibility and accountability.
Yeah. So I have so many questions, but that was one of them. Idea that, well, if we say like, oh, they're just musically inclined, that does, it sort of excuses us.
Absolutely.
From having to do the hard work. 'Cause if we don't sit down at a piano and, you know, play Rachmaninoff right away, which is difficult for anyone, even for Rachmaninoff, we don't even sort of, like, we're in the mentality of, well, I might as well not even try, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's that responsibility of, like, practice hard work, and then we're back into sort of like this grit thing.
Yeah. and so I think a really important, I don't want to just tear down this notion of innate talent without offering something in its place. And so I think a really important question is, where does talent come from? To just say it's nurture is
mm-hmm.
so broad and vague. Mm-hmm. And so in
before you offer that to people.
Yes.
I want to highlight two things. One, I think this is very obvious when we talk, because I've taught some writing classes for years, and I think the writing is where students especially get really hung up on this idea of some people are just naturally gifted writers. And it blows their mind whenever they realize that even amazing, quote unquote, magical people, let's say, do you have an example?
Sure. When it comes to writing?
Yes.
Shakespeare,
Wordsworth, anybody that...
The Bronte sisters, I think, are great.
Absolutely, right?
Example.
So any sort of like major literary person, it blows their mind to realize that they didn't just write a rough draft and that was the final product.
Yes.
Students really genuinely believe a lot of times that these amazing writers that go down in history wrote it right from their brain to the pen first time, and that was it. And they have no concept of the fact that they probably went through like 45 rough drafts.
Yes, right.
Yeah. Okay.
And that those early versions were so bad.
So bad.
Yes.
Right? And even though I spend the semester talking to them about it and talking to them about the research that shows how that happens and that writing is a process and all writing is rewriting and, you know, et cetera. Yeah. I mean, they don't get that the rough draft was probably so awful. Okay. So that, and then... again, before you offer the alternative you talked about, to reconceptualize the way that we perceive innate talent would radically alter the way we understand success and failure. Yes?
Yes, absolutely.
How?
I think... Again, I think this is particularly true in our society in the United States,
yeah,
that our value and self-worth is tied to our success and our failure.
Absolutely.
That might be true of all humanity, but it is less true in other cultures,
mm-hmm, right,
where success and failure is more about information regarding how to improve than it is about... anything to do with you and your value and your worth.
Okay.
And so what having a fixed mindset ends up leading to is you figuring out the game and how you can make yourself look as good as possible. I mean, we're talking about the first 18 years of my life, you know, especially my educational journey was tell me the rules for how I can make a good grade.
Right.
And I'll do it. And learning will not be on the table unless that's what needs to happen for me to make the good grade.
Oh, yes. Okay. So one radical change is just a radical re-envisioning of our educational system. Right?
That's absolutely right.
I mean, and I completely agree with you. One, we have set our students up for failure because we have taught them an education model that is a banking system model where they simply come and put their ATM card in and receive information and suddenly they are changed or transformed in some way. And two, I think you're right. They only care about the merit system where you tell me what you need for this grade and I will do it.
And I also think that we're entering into an age where we're now telling students, well, do what you're good at. Find what you're good at and do that. What could be wrong with such a philosophy? And what I'm coming to learn is that could be a really bad thing because it limits them to the talents that they've already developed.
Absolutely.
Even if they're not thinking in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
And closes the door on the fact that they could be great at something that maybe they don't have much experience in at this point, maybe don't even know exists at this point.
Right.
And locks them into the things that they're already good at what, 17, 18, 19?
Right. And that they may not be passionate about.
Absolutely.
I mean, maybe, but maybe not.
Yes.
And if you're saying do what you're good at instead of follow your passion.
Yes. Two very different things.
Very different. And I feel like we're doing the world a detriment to give that message.
And I love that, what you just said, doing the world a detriment, because I think the development of talent is not just about individual success.
Yes.
It's about how we contribute to one another in society.
Absolutely.
And so I think this is a societal issue. Mm-hmm. It's not just how do I get my child to be good in sports. It's how do I make the world a better place.
Absolutely. I love that. Okay. So now, what's the alternative that you promised us?
So I've packaged it really nicely.
Awesome.
For you.
Wonderful.
Yes. In what I'm calling the 5 M's of talent.
Okay.
So these are the 5 things that I think that they're the 5 most important things, at least.
Okay.
When it comes to the development of talent, conveniently all starting with the letter M.
That's amazing.
Well, thank you. It took some time.
Okay.
And the first is mindset.
Okay.
It's this notion of, if you don't believe fundamentally in your capacity to change, that will impact everything you do.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
The second is, might be a new word for you or for our listeners.
Mm-hmm.
It's myelin, M-Y-E-L-I-N.
Okay.
So
like a myelin sheath?
That's exactly what it is.
Okay.
Yeah. So in our brains, when we learn something, neurons connect to one another.
Right.
And this has the appearance of kind of a grayish color. Mm-hmm. And so they call that gray matter.
Okay.
For the longest time, we've ignored this other half of our brain, what ends up being about half of its contents, that we've dubbed white matter.
Uh-huh.
And because we thought it was filler.
Oh.
And now we've learned over the last 2 decades in particular,
mm-hmm.
that when you learn something, yes, these neurons connect, but the more those signals fire in your brain, the more of this white insulation forms around those axons, around those connections.
Right.
And the more of this myelin sheathing that you have, the faster, stronger, and better the connection.
Okay.
I have seen some studies that have found that a well-myelinated sheath, a well-myelinated brain signal, can travel 200 times faster than an unmyelinated brain signal.
Wow.
Other studies are estimating more like 1,000 times faster.
Oh.
So it brings to the forefront the question of, where is talent located?
Yeah.
And what I'm finding is, it doesn't matter if we're talking about soccer or baseball or physics or music or leadership, talent is located in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
It's not in your feet. It's not in your muscles.
Okay.
It's in your brain. It's these firing of signals that are so well myelinated because of the amount of time and effort that's gone into firing them repeatedly, that people can do things that I literally cannot imagine doing myself, because their brains are developed in ways that mine aren't.
Okay.
Mine isn't.
Right.
But the key word there is developed, that we're not born
practice.
With myelin.
Practice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're born with essentially none of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's through experience that things get myelinated. And so myelin comes down to this notion that the brain cannot do what the brain cannot learn, or what the brain has not learned.
Mm-hmm.
What the brain does is what the brain has learned. And and so that's the second M, myelin.
Okay. Good.
The third M.
Yes. I want to come back to myelin in a second, though.
Okay.
Okay. Third M.
The third M is mastery. This has gotten some attention because Anders Ericsson, who's the leading scholar on talent, his work was highlighted in Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers. And Gladwell paraphrased Ericsson's work by saying, it takes 10,000 hours to make an expert.
Okay.
And it's essentially that when we study talented people, what we find is two things. One, they practice a lot.
Yes.
And there are some estimates that it's certainly in the thousands of hours range. And if you were to choose a figure, which Ericsson says you shouldn't, but if you were to, 10,000 seems to be an approximate average for how long it takes people to reach expertise.
Okay.
The second part, and I think this is probably what bothers Ericsson the most when his work is paraphrased, is that it's not 10,000 hours of doing an activity. Mm-hmm. It's 10,000 hours of doing an activity for the sake of improvement, what he would call deliberate practice.
Okay.
What I kind of dub difficult practice.
Yeah.
If it's not difficult, you're not gaining from it. And it's it's thousands of hours of that kind of practice where you're pushing your limits, challenging yourself, stretching yourself, that leads to mastery.
I mean, and I love this because I don't remember the artist, but I remember reading one time that there was an artist who somebody said, oh, you're a famous artist, can you draw my portrait? And they did in like 30 seconds. And then the person was like, oh, great, how much do I owe you? And the artist was like, you know, several thousand dollars. And they go, well, but it only took you 30 seconds to do this. And they were like, yeah, but it took me years and years to be able to do this in 30 seconds. And I think what you're highlighting is when we are stuck in the innate fixed mentality, we devalue all of the like thousands of hours of work that went into over not just deliberately practicing, but overcoming our notions of failure. Yes.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen these T-shirts that say, you know, if it's talent versus hard work, I'll choose hard work, you know, every time or whatever.
Right.
And I think what's problematic about that notion is that it's not talent versus hard work. It's that talent is the result of the hard work.
Yes.
That it isn't this either or where, okay, some people have innate talent and some people work hard.
Right.
It's there is no talent. Mm-hmm. If you remove the hard work from anyone and everyone, the talent is no longer there. The talent is an effect.
Mm-hmm.
It's a it's an effect from the cause of hard work, among other things.
Okay. And I think this highlights another important piece of your argument here is you're not trying to say that like talent doesn't exist. You are subverting the dichotomy between talent and hard work.
Yeah, I really appreciate you highlighting that. Absolutely. Okay. I believe in talent. I think we vary greatly in our talent. I think what we're seeing has nothing to do with particular ways that people were born.
Okay.
I think what we're seeing has everything to do with the access, opportunity, resources, and experiences of different people.
Okay, great. All right, now, what are we on, four?
We're on four.
Okay, let's do it.
So we had mindset, we had myelin, we had mastery.
Yes.
When you understand what it takes to master a craft, you begin to form a whole new appreciation for the fourth M, which is motivation. And I think motivation can be something that's treated as cute and fluffy and who in their right mind would spend thousands upon thousands of hours of deliberate difficult practice on the piano? I could never in a million years imagine myself doing that. And yet there are people who do that
every day.
What it takes for someone who is better than 90% of the population to still seek to improve is remarkable.
Yeah.
When everyone that you encounter is telling you how great and wonderful you are, to still find ways to improve your skill level, it takes a level of motivation that I think is mysterious in some ways, but there's also some really solid research over the decades that have clued us in to what can help with motivation. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, we can't take that factor out. There is something about each of us that where we would not do what it takes to become an expert in particular things. And this, of course, goes directly back to mm-hmm. you talking about what we're passionate about versus right. what we're good at.
Right.
There has to be a passion there. It can start extrinsically in the sense of it can start outside of yourself. Mm-hmm. But eventually you have to take some ownership if you're really going to reach the level of expertise that we admire as a society.
Yeah. Okay. And now we're to the five.
Perhaps maybe, I feel like I'm picking on the United States a lot in this talk, but
sometimes it needs to be picked on.
Sometimes. I just think we underappreciate mentorship.
Yes.
In this country.
Okay.
Maybe more than any other country in the world.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And that's the fifth M.
Okay.
With every talented person is a great teacher, or most often great teachers.
Mm.
So we love to talk about Michael Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about you, Josh. I've heard about Michael Jordan my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
I have never heard his talent related to the fact that Michael Jordan had one of the best college coaches of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Jordan had one of the best NBA coaches mm-hmm. of all time.
Mm-hmm.
That before that particular NBA coach, Michael Jordan never won a championship. Mm-hmm. And then with this particular coach, he won six. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I look at the lives of Albert Einstein, Mozart, Michael Jordan, Abraham Lincoln, people that we greatly admire, that we are sure are some of the most talented people in history,
mm-hmm.
they all had teachers.
Yes.
Really good teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And so mentorship is the fifth M. But I want to say that it's not just in the professional teaching relationship. I think parents are important, and I think peers are really important mm-hmm. too, because we don't often think of peers as teachers,
right.
but they are.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Einstein, was, you know, is often considered the face of intelligence, and sometimes his name is used as a synonym for intelligence. I'm no Einstein kind of thing.
Right. Right.
And he was great at theoretical physics because he practiced theoretical physics. He was bad at math. Mm-hmm. And so
yeah.
he used his friends to help him with the math.
Mm-hmm.
He married someone who was really good at more of the detailed oriented aspects of the math and the physics.
Mm-hmm.
And she helped him a lot with his work.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, even someone like Einstein that we want to put on this pedestal, when you actually read about his life, and I think this is true of all great people,
mm-hmm.
when you look at the details, it's not that it's less inspiring, but it's less magical for sure.
Yeah, right. And I think there are always these amazing voices, these mentors, which kind of reminds me of an overall sort of theme here that amazingly starts with an M, which is mimic or mimetic, right? Because in many ways, you know, all of these things are related to, especially mentorship, right? Mimicking. Through mimesis, learning these different skills like math. Like if you're bad at math, but you love theoretical physics, and then you accumulate the positive habits of a mentor,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
Like you begin to mimic those, you know, Michael Jordan learned through mimesis from these great coaches.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I have, again, I know we're almost out of time. I just have so many questions. So let me just narrow it down really quickly to two. One, what do you say to folks who talk about a child prodigy?
So when, as a professor, in order to do research, the kind of research that I want to do, mm-hmm. I have to go through an institutional review board
right.
and a lot of process. Fortunately, as a parent, I don't have to do any of that stuff.
Right.
And so I'm very thankful to my wife, who has let me do all sorts of experiments on my children because
great.
I sound like I've believed in this my whole life, but I've really come full circle in terms of I was sure that talent was innate.
Mm.
And I've come at this with a lot of skepticism and have had to really try to understand, is this really true? I mean,
yeah.
And
that's a great way to approach research, by the way. I just want everybody to know that, like, that's not always what happens when people approach research. You know, they go into something wanting to find what they want to find. And here you are saying, you know, you were a real big believer in innate talent and you came at it skeptically, but you've been persuaded.
Yeah, and I was persuaded by looking at the research, but when I was bought into this, Josh,
mm-hmm.
is when I started messing with my kids. And I each of them have their own experiences and challenges.
Right.
And when I started to not just share this with them, poor children, but to try to apply this to things that they were facing and to see the remarkable results, I'm sold out now.
Yeah.
And I feel like this has to go beyond me and my family. And so I would not describe my children as child prodigies by in any sense of the word. But I think the principles are the same, that whenever you find a child prodigy, and Anders Ericsson has done a lot of this research himself,
okay.
What you find are not people who are impressively talented. They're people who are impressively talented for their age.
Okay.
So child prodigies
right.
almost
right.
never okay. exceed the skill of skilled adults.
Like a master craftsman.
Yes.
Yes.
A child prodigy in chess
uh-huh.
Is someone who should not be that good at chess at that young of an age.
Gotcha.
Not somebody who is necessarily beating adults
right.
who are skilled in chess.
Okay.
And essentially, you take these five M's and you see it in these child prodigies at extremely young ages.
Okay.
And so
okay.
my favorite example of a child prodigy is Mozart.
Right.
It is not common knowledge that Mozart's father was a composer.
Mm-hmm.
And not mm-hmm. just a composer, but a composer who was kind of obsessed with his children being composers.
Okay.
And actually, Mozart had an older sibling, and his father tried out some things on that older sibling, learned from his mistakes, and then applied it better for Mozart.
Okay.
And some of Mozart's first compositions are actually in his father's handwriting.
Okay.
Of course, his father said, this is all Mozart. This
right.
is not me.
Right, right.
But we now know better. Uh-huh. And so child prodigies are people who are gaining in terms of their thousands of hours of difficult practice,
right?
And who have access to teachers because their parents are investing in them, or because the parents are the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Tiger Woods might be a good example of that,
or Michael Jackson.
Yes,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And they're making progress relative to other children their age.
Mm-hmm.
That's remarkable,
right?
But it's also very explainable when you look at their lives.
Okay. Very good. Well, we are out of time, but I mean, and there's so many, many other ways we could go with this, but thank you for joining us. And, you know, our podcast is about stories of hope and healing, and I think this research is an amazing way of you contributing to the not just the Baylor community, but also, you know, like we said earlier, you know, it's sort of a detriment to the world to think only in very limited things about innate talent. So if there's one thing that you could say to us based on your research that would help open our eyes a little bit, what might that one thing be?
I think that one thing would be that if there's something that you are passionate about, maybe even something that you feel called to, to understand that what you're being called to is to develop in that area, that talent is cultivated and developed and earned, and there's no such thing as just being endowed with these gifts. We're endowed with a calling, and we're endowed with an incredible ability to learn that I think should give us all hope.
Great. That's wonderful. Excellent. Thank you, Rishi, for again joining us today. And thank you so much, all of you, for joining us for this episode. And until next time, be kind, be courageous, and remember that a stranger is just a neighbor you haven't met yet. See you next time.